In the culture war, there are no winners, just podcasters. Only a few are willing to risk their lives in the face of some of the dumbest ideas to have ever captured human civilization. Every week, we, Megan Dom and Sarah Hayter, humbly accept this mission to bring you conversations that are equal parts stunning, brave, and fully optimized. Welcome to A Special Place in Hell. Morning, Sarah.
Afternoon.
It's afternoon for you. It's morning for me. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. I want to thank everybody for their kind wishes about my foot. I know that last time we had a riveting discussion about my fears that I had gout. But in fact, it probably is just a stress fracture. And it seems that it was caused by the most unlikely of culprits, which were my formerly high performance hiking shoes. Actually, the most healthy, comfortable shoes destroyed my feet. Yeah.
That sucks.
No, it's okay.
Which ones? Can you talk about it? Okay, you should tell me afterwards.
I'm not going to say the brand.
You can tell me
afterwards. No, you know what it is? It's just they were too old. Like, I have a lot of, you know, boots and high heels and things that are bad for my feet. And then who knows? And who would think? In the end, it was my hiking shoes, because I was walking with my friend the other day and the shoes literally started falling apart as I walked. Mm. And I thought, oh, I guess you're not supposed to have these longer than 3 years. And as it seems that that was the problem.
Okay. So
anyway, thank you for your good wishes, everybody. Don't have gout or goiter or anything else, as far as I know.
I might have COVID.
Oh, COVID.
Right now, yeah.
It's
had a family member
foot?
Bring it into the house.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And she's staying with us, so I think probably I have COVID.
Okay.
It's okay. I feel okay. And then it's another opportunity to take Sudafed, so.
Okay. Well, maybe you need to drink the green drink or the product promoted by one Andrew Huberman. We're going to discuss a couple of things today, but we're going to start with the latest, not even the latest, but the New York Magazine story about which everyone has been abuzz the last week.
Oh, wait, can we pause for just a second? Because I'd like to just talk a little bit about Daniel Kahneman. Did you hear about that?
Yes.
It's so sad. It made me so sad. I mean, he was pretty old.
Yeah, he was in 90, the 90s. 90? Yeah.
90. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was really deeply depressing. I just feel like there are all these great minds that are dropping like flies and we're left with nothing. But
what do you mean? What about all these YouTubers?
Right.
What are you talking about?
What's going on anywhere? You know, like, I just don't feel like we're cultivating this kind of personality anymore. And I feel really I found out about it late at night yesterday and was just like bummed and woke up a little upset.
Hmm. Joe Lieberman also died.
Oh, he did?
Yesterday.
Oh. Mm. I care less about that. I just remember him
You're
as like
an anti-Semite.
Kahneman is Jewish, isn't he?
I don't know.
I think he is. Well, he's Israeli.
Okay. Oh, that's right.
Oh. Well. Must be.
Okay, you're allowed then. But was he sick? Was it sudden with Kahneman?
I think he was just, I don't know. I think his partner said, and the interesting thing is that his partner at the moment is the widow of his partner, Amos Tversky. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but they were, you know, the team is worked together for like a decade. There was a book written about them by Michael Lewis. And the Nobel Prize winning work that Daniel Kahneman, you know, eventually was awarded a Nobel Prize for, that was done with Amos Tversky. But
oh, wow.
Amos was dead already. So they don't award the prize to dead people.
And he married his widow.
He didn't marry. They were just living together.
Partners,
like after.
And what was
there? I think there was a long period between like Amos died and then there was a period and now they're, he was living.
That happens more than you'd think. What's their age gap? Do we know? We might talk about age gaps later on.
Yeah, I guess it must not be that high because
he's 90 and she's 80. Probably. That'd be scandalous. Okay. Yeah.
Well, that's really, really sad. I loved Thinking Fast and Slow was like one of the first serious nonfiction books that I ever purchased with my own money as an adult, like fresh out of college.
Oh.
And it had a huge impact on me. And it was one of those books that I gifted to a lot of people and they're probably really unhappy about it. But, you know, now they can say they own it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You did your part. Yeah. Well, time marches on, sadly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about a couple of things, namely the cover story. New York Magazine is just killing it these days.
Killing me.
We could actually devote this entire podcast to New York Magazine. Maybe we should just reframe this. And so we just talk about whatever is in New York Magazine and or The Cut that particular week.
Yeah. What are they doing? What's their plan? Just to throw... I mean, it just feels like there's tabloids now, you know, like glorified tabloids. It works, I guess, because here we are talking about it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they used to have some good stuff. I mean, I feel like this is kind of a formula. Like we see this with The Atlantic as well. Like they'll run some like really, really good stuff and the kind of stuff that people like us approve of. And then they'll just do a reversal and run some wackadoo thing. But yeah, the New York Magazine, reliably wackadoo, but long form wackadoo. So that's always appreciated. So yeah, there's a cover story by Carrie Howley about Andrew Huberman, who is an extremely popular YouTuber that yet, you know, nonetheless, many people have no idea who he is, but many, many people follow him closely. And this is framed as a huge scandal, something that will rock the world of neuroscience and
YouTube podcasters,
optimizers, brofluencers,
mm-hmm.
but amounted to a bit of a nothing burger. So, do you want to? What you thought of it?
I don't know if it's a nothing burger exactly in that, like, nothing burger in the sense that I don't feel as if it told me a lot about him, Huberman. I don't feel like I learned a lot about him, even though it's written in a way that now you're like, these things are being revealed about this man who's, you know, and this psychology, and she's like peering into it and weaves a story. She's a good writer. She does a good job. But I found the piece to be really sick. I don't know who this writer is, but I hate her now. You know, I just don't like why. I don't know why you would do this to somebody. I just don't understand what kind of person takes it upon themselves to do this kind of character defamation, or assassination, even like that it seemed as if she was trying to get something, you know, desperately trying to get something on this guy, and what she did get was just that he is kind of a flake when it comes to friends, and he might be kind of a womanizer and uses, you know, modern therapy talk to manipulate women into, you know, sticking around and ignoring their common sense,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
And that's the story.
Right. It wasn't that he had committed any kind of fraud with his audience necessarily, or that he had, you know, there was no sort of actual content transaction. This was all personal
stuff.
Yeah,
he's maybe a bad guy.
He's a bad boyfriend,
yeah,
for sure.
Maybe he's a bad, yeah, that's it. I mean, do we even know for sure? I don't believe this. I refuse to believe it. I just don't. I think it's so easy to paint a story like this. Everyone has bad moments, and it is just, it's too easy for people to just pick them apart and weave a narrative. I've seen it happen 100 times. I feel like we've seen it, you know, like in the culture war, play out many, many times with like Armie Hammer was a recent example. That's what I was thinking of as I was reading this. I was thinking about Armie Hammer and how everybody was talking about how he's definitely a, you know, sex pest, cannibal, whatever. Like, he's this extreme creep. And then it turned out that it was kind of a lie, you know, woven by a very angry woman.
Right.
And an accomplice. And it worked, right? Like, we were all, but I do feel like with the Armie Hammer thing, part of the reason I was so upset and sick of over it is that it made me feel as if in reading it, in believing it, in spreading it, even a little bit, I didn't do much of that, but even a little bit, I am an accomplice to the real crime, which is of, you know, this vicious woman wanting to destroy his reputation, like the reputation of a man. I don't know what their relationship really is about, but she wanted to hurt him. She successfully hurt him and his career, destroyed it maybe, and I was a part of it, right? I'm now...
Well, it's a good thing we're talking about this.
Guilty, yeah. Right? Like, and but so what I can do, you know, I feel like the good I can do is to say, don't believe this. Don't believe this, and if anybody in your circle believes it, tell them not to believe it.
Okay,
tell
well, we should explain what it is, for starters. Okay, so Andrew Huberman, he is 48 now. He is a YouTuber, but he also is, like, I guess technically a Stanford professor. He says he has a lab.
He has faculty.
He said he has, you know, technically speaking, he has a lab at Stanford. He authors papers, you know, like, for the Journal of Neuroscience. He's into cells. He's into, like, all kinds of scientific speak that YouTubers can sort of nod along with. And he's got millions and millions of followers. I mean, he is huge. So I guess the short version is, you know, I don't know if he's ever been married. He's not a family man. Let's just put it that way. So he's a middle-aged guy by now, very jacked, very, you know, obsessed with health, one of these bros. Mm-hmm. And he had a girlfriend. She's called Sarah in the piece, not her real name. Mm-hmm. We learn about how they met. Sarah is in her mid-40s, although she looks a decade younger, also extremely health conscious. And, you know, the she's introduced in the piece as somebody who just, like, has her act together. She's a woman who keeps track of things. She was an entrepreneur who could organize a meeting, a skill she would later need for reasons she could not possibly have predicted. And so she talks about meeting him in 2018. He messaged her on Instagram. He was a little deceptive about where he lived. He said he owned a house in a wealthy city called Piedmont, separate from the sort of adjacent to Oakland, California. In fact, he lived off of Piedmont Avenue, which is in Oakland. So these are the kinds of lies. And anyway, so they get into a relationship, and the short story is he's just, you know, flaky, and he's in a bunch of relationships with other women and is will disappear for long periods of time and come up with weird excuses. But he's also, like, trying to do IVF with her. Was it Sarah he's trying to do IVF with? One of these women,
the main woman. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Sarah. And by the end of this, the women, there's about, I don't know, three or four other women. And by the end, they kind of all find one another. One of them's in New York. They all have sort of different personalities. Like, one of them's super beautiful. Another one is super smart and, you know, lives in New York, and another is this. And so they sort of find each other, and they're sleuths, and they, you know, start their own little text thread, and they bond. It really does feel like the makings of a television series. Like, I feel like this should go straight to Netflix, and perhaps it will.
I hope not. I do not.
I think it would be good.
Writer to be rewarded. Like, so long as she's not rewarded and somebody else does it and it's not based on his life so directly, I'd be okay with it. I just think that this is really sleazy. Like, it's a really sleazy kind of thing to do. And I don't understand why we allow it, you know? Like, it's just like, this is his private life. And you are allowed to be a not amazing person, but that doesn't make it public information. You know, that doesn't mean that you don't have a right to privacy anymore. That doesn't mean that it's worthy, like newsworthy. Like, what does that mean anymore? What is it?
Right.
What does a story have to be to make it to the intelligencer on New York Magazine other than just getting them clicks? Like, they will literally do anything. Like,
I agree with you that the piece doesn't really, there's no there there. The argument I have heard is that unlike an actor or a performer or somebody in the arts, if you are presenting yourself as a person of science and you are a researcher and have information and are telling people facts about material reality that they are supposed to be taking seriously, if you are then revealed to be like a pathological liar, that is more relevant than somebody like Armie Hammer or somebody who just...
No, it isn't, because all of those things can be like checked. You know, like if somebody is presenting information to you, you can check that information. You can find out that he's a pathological liar or just not to be trusted without digging into his personal life. And this expose doesn't actually tell us about his personal life. Like, we have to take everything this writer is saying or implying with a, like, I mean, I don't even want to say like grain of salt, because it's just, we have no idea.
It was fact checked. I don't think
what does that mean, right? Like,
everything
can be technically true without, you can ignore large aspects of like relevant context in a situation, and you can make anything really appear. I don't think that's hard to do if you are imaginative and kind of like, you know, psycho and are willing, you know, really, really want to make the story happen. You can make it happen. I'm not trying to defend him, because I don't know what kind of person this is. It is possible that everything she lays out here is true. Maybe it's worse, you know, maybe it's actually worse. And the women that this reporter contacted aren't the women that he has mistreated the most. Those are just like, you know, in the shadows somewhere and licking their wounds or whatever. Maybe that's true. It's just that this is not a reliable way to understand what is going on in someone's private life. Like, it is so easy to whip, like, to create any kind of story about somebody if they do live a complicated life. You know, if they do have maybe, like, they're not a perfect person, they've done some messed up things here and there. Now you can make him out to be a villain if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what's happening. Maybe this is accurate. Maybe it's inaccurate because he's worse. Maybe it's inaccurate because he's a lot better than that, and these women are psychotic. You know, we don't know. We don't know. And so it shouldn't be evidence at all, right? Like, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, I don't think this is evidence one way or the other.
I mean,
I don't think it registers.
Right. I think the facts in and of themselves are surely correct. I mean, these magazines still have fact checkers. So it's not like there are, you know, not like there's a timeline that's inaccurate, or it's not like everything that these women told the reporter were not then called by fact checkers and verified. I mean, that is the policy. For all of New York's magazines' failings, and we say what you will about it, they still have a fact checking department. So, but yeah, I mean, the framing has its own agenda. Carrie Howley is a phenomenal writer. She's done incredible work. She has some great books. She wrote a fantastic piece about Britney Spears, House of Spears, back in 2022. She's really excellent. She is not somebody that was like particularly ideological. Well, I mean, she certainly was not like on the woke squad. Historically, she was an editor at Reason Magazine in the past. She is the one that wrote the piece in New York Magazine about the sexual revolution debate that you were in and Barry Weiss. And I was totally flummoxed by it. And I wrote a Substack about this post about it. She reported on something that I was there and I saw with my own eyes. And I was not seeing what she saw. So it was one of those strange, like gaslighty, sorry to use that word, kinds of experiences to read the piece. And so that seems to be going on here. I don't want to talk about writers and I'm not going to read their minds. Lots of things go on. when you pitch a piece, I mean, again, I don't know, but I have been in the position of, you know, reporting out a piece, the editor wants you to do it, the editor's pushing you, whatever, and the story's just not there. And sometimes they kill the piece, but sometimes they force you to shoehorn it into something that it's not. And it sucks when that happens.
She has a choice.
She has it. Yeah.
It's an unethical thing to do, and she shouldn't do it.
Clearly Carrie Howley does not like the heterodox crowd. She doesn't like them.
She doesn't like them. And this is a, there's a lot of implications. Like the way she writes, she implicates a lot of things without, she doesn't outright say it, which is what makes me so, which made me so angry as I was reading it. I was like, as I was just scrolling through, like, mm-hmm. I felt as if I was being manipulated, you know, and I don't know anything about him. I don't know anything about him. I've never listened to an episode of the, Huberman. I kept saying Huberman in my head, but never listened to an episode. I might have seen clips from him here and there. Might have. He doesn't really ring a huge bell. I'm not attracted to the kind of content that he puts out. So I don't know. You know, I don't know what, I don't have any kind of affiliation with him. It's just that I know that, one, this just doesn't seem like it's newsworthy at all. Like, it just feels as if someone is airing someone else's dirty laundry that the public has no right into knowing, right? Like, I mean, if he indeed he is this man, he's a kind of scoundrel and he treats women terribly, that is for, you know, that is a fact and a reality for his private context, you know, his friends, his family, his associates.
He should suffer the consequences privately, in his personal life.
Right. Yeah. They should litigate it, and they should, you know, they should punish him if indeed that is happening. And I have known so many cases, and I've, like, you know, just personally working with a lot of different kinds of people, many of whom were in the public eye, where the private story and the public story were just completely different. Sometimes victims were the aggressors and the aggressors were victims. It's just so easy to get it wrong. And for people to manipulate things to make it appear as if it's one way in the public, that I have a huge amount of skepticism for stories like this. I think, you know, you have to be in his contact. You have to be one of his friends to know how real is this, given what you know about him. Could it be real? You know, and then you punish him privately by not being his friend anymore or whatever. You know, like there's a social consequence for a social, like, misbehavior, I guess, or a pattern of harmful behavior. But this is not a crime. So we don't need to know about
it. He's such a character. You know what it is? Again, like, I really think that this would be such a great series. And I don't know, but I can imagine pitching this as a television series. Like, oh yeah, there's this whole world of optimizers and these bro YouTuber influencer guys, and they have this, like, you know, kind of way about them, and these people worship them. Like, and you've got these women that have sort of been circling around him and dating him. Like, that would be a great limited series. Like, that would be a great 8 or 10 episode, half hour sort of dark comedy. And I can imagine being a writer and pitching that to Hollywood executives and them saying, okay, that could be cool, but we need some IP, we need some intellectual property, go and write an article about it that we can then option. That happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that that happened, but I can imagine that scenario. I mean, I've had it happen numerous times. I've pitched something and they go, oh, that's great, but why don't you go write a novel about that, and then we'll option the novel. It's like, oh, okay, all right, great, see you in a month. Like, this is the sort of thing. I mean, this is so funny. Like, I'm just gonna read a little bit of this, so in case people haven't read it, because we're being a little abstract here. Okay, so Eve is another one of the women. Eve is an ethereally beautiful actress, the kind of woman from whom it is hard to look away. While Sarah exudes a winsome, chaotic energy, Eve is intimidatingly collective. Eve saw Andrew on Raya in 2020. Okay, so he's on dating apps. Also, just like, they should do a whole series on Raya, which is the app for people who are famous. Apparently, you have to be.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Shit, I'm signing up. Wait, are you?
Okay, we need to have a whole episode. They'll let you. I'm sure they'll let you on if you're married. Just don't tell them. But
why don't you get on it and do a special report?
I would
anyway.
I would. People have suggested that I do Raya, and I just can't even imagine the douchebaggery factor.
Who
on
knows?
It. Anyway,
no, okay.
You have to be, but you have to be referred by another, you know, special person to be on Raya. Anyway, so Eve saw Andrew on Raya in 2020 and messaged him on Instagram. They went for a swim in Venice. What does that mean? Like in the ocean? Okay. And he complimented her form.
Dirty Venice water.
Exactly. What? At night. Right. Exactly. And he complimented her form. You're definitely, he said, on the faster side of the distribution. Brilliant. Mm. She found him to be an extraordinary listener, and she liked the way he appeared to be interested in her internal life. He was busy all the time with his book and eventually the podcast, his dog, responsibilities at Stanford. I'm willing to do the repair work on this, he said when she called him out for standing her up. This sucks, but it doesn't deter my desire and commitment to see you. Exactly. I mean, I think that it's just sort of so irresistible, his whole comportment.
Okay, but so tell me about this like fact-checking process. So some of these things are claims that the women are making he said to me, right? How do you fact-check that?
The fact-checker calls, the fact-checker knows who the women are.
Yeah.
The fact-checker calls them and verifies it again and again and again.
What?
Of course. Yeah.
So if I just stick to my story, you know, Megan once told me we need to make out with Hugo or else, you know, like what? Like,
then it would say she said. Then it would say she said. But like the fact checker is going to look for going to want to see text messages, emails, anything. I mean, it's like getting audited by the IRS. I mean, look, I wrote in the 90s, you know, I wrote a couple pieces for the New Yorker, and one of them had to do with being in debt. This was sort of like my big piece, my misspent youth, and it had to do with being in debt and my student loans and all this. And I had to supply my tax returns to the New Yorker. I had to give them so much information to fact check the piece. But you don't think anything could
have, I mean, so with the rape on campus and all those pieces that those, somehow got through, right. You know, that, I think that was somebody wants it enough.
Yeah, I don't know.
Do they?
Yeah,
the Rolling
Stone. Yeah, the fact checking of the Rolling Stone with the Jackie case. Yeah, that was an example. That was an absolute catastrophe, like in the fact checking world. Like in that case, they said this person is so traumatized you can't fact check her. I think that actually was a. I really do believe. Say what you will about New York Magazine. I do think they have fact checking department. Because there's real, I mean, look, people can get sued,
but it's this serious. Is not the kind of thing that's easy to fact check, right? But, like, it's like you can know that, okay, they went to Venice, you know, she can mm-hmm. give you evidence of that. She can give you evidence that they went for a swim, maybe, you know, like here's where we were that day and here's where we stayed. But everything else about it seems like it's easy to turn a normal message, like a normal conversation into a mildly creepy one, and then you do that to all the conversations, and now he's a creep because he keeps being mildly creepy.
Right, but see, my guess is there were other details that were not fact checkable, so they got left out of the story. Because that's what happens. If you can't verify them, they're not in the story. So it might, like you said earlier, it might have been that there was so much more.
Maybe she's a creep. Like maybe she responds and says something creepy about bell curves too. Like maybe she was egging him on and he didn't, you know, like.
Right. Look, I'm not defending the piece. I'm just saying that this is what happens. Yeah, and yeah. There's so many weird things. Like then they say there's this detail about him giving her or one of them getting the HPV virus.
Yeah, which I found to be very.
Well.
That can just sit in your system for
also
years.
Like the HPV virus is nothing. I mean, it's not nothing. Like if you don't treat it and it develops over the years, it can be a cause of cervical cancer, which is why you get pap smears and also why they invented the Gardasil vaccine. But HPV is like extremely common and it also goes away on its own.
Dormant
I'm sorry.
For a while. So I think there's no
you
smoking
can't
gun.
Know
also,
where you got
can't
it.
Know,
right.
Yeah, you can't know that you got it from him.
Right. Right.
Which is a crate. That's what I'm saying. That knowing that it could be, they're just like, maybe it's really, I did get it. It's true. Fact checked that I went to the doctor and I found out that I had HPV. Here's my doctor's record. And here's that happened. Okay. That is true. But is it true that he gave it to her? You know, like, right. is that right. true? And do they make that clear? Like, no.
Yeah.
They imply it heavily that he did. Why do they include it? You know, and then just keep, if you just do that over and over and over, you can paint a picture of somebody being a very, like, creepy dude. Like, I know somebody who had a blog post written about him that was, like the woman anonymized everything. But she basically took a kind of a weird date and made it out to be this, like, outrageous situation.
Oh, was it with Aziz Ansari?
No, it wasn't, like, a sexual assault. It was just, like, weird stuff, like, awkward conversations, weirdnesses.
Oh, God forbid.
And I mean, and she was a funny writer. So she was a writer that was trying to be funny, and she kind of fictionalized a real story, and his friends send it to him, and he has good humor. So he, you know, laughed it off and reached out to her about it, and they had a laugh about it, you know, which is, I guess that happens. But it could have easily been that, you know, that she was not so nice, that he was not so forgiving. And instead of this, like, hilarious story that she's anonymizing, she's personalizing it and just taking these real true facts that actually happened and turning them into something really creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I'm sorry. Like, I know, like, it's a funny story. This is a good writer. And he's kind of a strange guy. The whole thing is kind of, I don't know. I don't listen to guys like this. I just don't.
No, but I mean, what do you think of this, you know, sort of conventional wisdom that if, like, especially men, if they're going to be really powerful, if they are politicians, if they are very powerful businessmen, they are going to be narcissists and have certain traits. Mm-hmm. The very traits that allowed them to succeed on such a high level professionally are probably not going to be very pleasant or useful in their personal lives. And that's just that's sort of the transaction. Like, if you are a woman and you're with a man like that, that's kind of the deal. Not that, you know, there needs to be, like, you know, sleeping with five other women at the same time, but there is just going to be a level of self-absorption and self-regard that over-indexes for somebody who's incredibly successful in that way. And I'm sure that's true with very successful women as well. I mean, you know, if you are the traits that are necessary to achieve, you know, at an extremely high level are not going to work so well in your personal life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is generally true of any kind of extreme behavior, whatever, you know, even if it is, it's excellence in this way, like he's gotten so much success, or he's found a way to make a lot of money, or he's, you know, anything very extreme. Not to say that it's necessarily the case, because there are a lot of people who are deeply successful, or like, I feel like athletes are often this way. Like, athletes will be successful, be wealthy, and then also have normal lives, like manage to do that somehow. I mean, not always, maybe. Of course, like many of them also then they'll do what this guy is doing and just have a lot, like, of different women around,
like
them.
Tiger Woods.
I agree with you. I think that there's something about it, and there is something about, I think, just the need for stimulation, you know. I think that there are a lot of these guys, this guy, like, I mean, he's hyper productive, you know. Hyper productive people need a lot of stimulation. They just need a lot of. And so I think that a normal married life would never work for a guy like this. Like, he needs to have drama, like, and he needs to have all these pressure and, like, just all this weight. Just, he needs kind of a degenerate sex life, because that's it. Yeah. That's who he is. And that is the only thing that will work for him. And it's kind of sick. And I think that, I don't know, like, I think if a guy like this, like, showed interest in me, I would be so wary, you know?
Well, like, that's the other thing. Like, with a lot of this, the way these women are portrayed as being so taken in by him and so gullible, like, you're just reading this and you're like, seriously? Like, no, don't forgive him. Like, this is the moment when you leave. Just hang up the phone, walk out of the house. I don't understand. But again, like, that's us.
I mean, and that's, yeah. That happens a lot with women who get played, where they'll later say there were all these red flags, actually. Like, there were all these times where I was like, but then I said to myself, no, you know, I wanted to believe in him because he's sexy and he makes a lot of money and he's famous and he's also super smart. So, of course, you want to believe that he is this into you, that when he says he can't make it, like, to an event or whatever, that he really can't make it. And he's really just, you know, and that you're special because this special man has chosen you, you know?
No,
and I think
I know.
That I totally get why they're falling into it, but they are not, they are also like adults, you know, and you should, it's how many red flags do you need to see before you are an idiot? You know, yes, you're a victim, but you're also a victim with like a dunce hat on. You know what I mean? Like that you should have seen this.
Right.
Maybe that's why he picked you, because you're not that smart.
I know. I mean, maybe it is like this whole kind of world of Instagram. And like, I mean, I even aside from this piece, like, I wonder what you think of this, because I'm always amazed when I hear women, especially younger women who are like, you know, dating in their 20s or 30s or whatever, and they'll be like, oh, he didn't call me, but he liked my Instagram. Like, I saw that he, you know, he saw my reel, or he liked this, or he hit this, and like, but you know, I know he likes me, but he hasn't texted me. And I just want to turn around and be like, he's not into you.
He doesn't like you.
He's just not that into you. Like, the greatest book ever written is He's Just Not That Into You, by Liz DiCillo and Greg Behrendt. I mean, it's if you have to ask, he's not into you.
Yep.
It's that simple.
Well, I do think we talked about this before. I feel like a deja vu or something. But I do think that reality has shifted a little bit more recently, just because men do now, I think, younger guys especially, they are less worried or more worried about approaching a woman and being seen as creepy. So I think with like the caveat is that if he's younger than like 35, the situation is a little bit more different. He could be interested, but he just doesn't want to come across as a creep.
Okay, but if he went out with you one time and you had a good date, but then he's not calling you again, but he's liking your Instagram
post. And you
initiate
and he doesn't really answer back. Okay, right.
He's not into you.
Yeah. And then take that message. And because if he wanted to, he would call back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Men are not that, they're not that hard to read. You know, you can tell when a man is interested and how much more to push on. But I think that like guys like this can see. And by guys like this, I don't mean maybe he's not like this. Again, I'm withholding judgment.
Guys
from
like this character
specific man,
portrayed in the piece.
Yes, right. Like the character, the character known as Andrew Huberman in this piece. They can smell this kind of desperation in a woman. You know,
totally.
They can see that a good woman really, really likes them. And so that means they can get away with a lot. You know, I remember talking to a friend about this like many years ago, and he is kind of well off and knows other like super well off guys. And we were talking about gold diggers, and I was like, how, like, are you worried about it? You know, like gold diggers. And he's like, you know, no, like I kind of like them because we all know what's up, you know, and you can sort of get away with a lot with those kind of girls because they do want that from you.
Their bar is low. They will forgive you over and over again.
Right. So you just know where you stand, and it's an easier, like funner kind of thing to do when you're young and in the mood for that kind of thing. Not all guys are into that, but I think that some of these guys, like, they need a lot. They need a lot of stimulation. They just need a lot. It's not even it's not just love life. They need everything about their world to be ultra, hyper, super, duper optimized.
Yeah, it's a dopamine. Like, well, it's a dopamine rush. I mean, I was also, somebody had written something, or there was somebody had posted something recently about like the archetype of the crazy girl, like the crazy hot mess, and why that is so appealing to men. Like, not even just crazy, like she's wacky, but she's super manipulative, and she, like, you know, she was your, she, you were dating her best friend and then she cheated on, you know, or whatever. Like she's mm-hmm. just got a, she's just bad news. Okay. She's a bad news chick, but she's hot and she's a mess and she's erratic. And, you know, she's all over you 1 second and then slamming the door in your face the second, like the next, like that is very seductive to a lot of men. I think to a lot of people, I think that kind of high drama relationship is an aphrodisiac for a lot of people. But I'm very fascinated about like why that happens or like what kind of brain wiring would lend itself to being turned on by that kind of thing over a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, I agree that it's definitely a thing. There's definitely something to it. I've seen it too often.
Yeah, and it feels like an excuse. It's actually an excuse for getting on with your life, because the thing with those kinds of relationships is they take up so much time. I mean, they're really debilitating.
They're a distraction.
Like if you want to like succeed professionally or do anything else in your life, you will be hobbled by having that kind of relationship. I mean, you might as well have an addiction or something. Like it is absolutely debilitating. But it feels like you're, I guess what it is that it feels like you're in your life. Like you, you know, you feel like you're, you feel like you're alive. It's like when people have affairs, this is what they say, you know, it's not, they know it's bad. Even if they have no intention of leaving their spouse, mm-hmm. they're with this other person. It mm-hmm. makes them feel alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's obviously a powerful thing.
I just think, what's interesting about the character of Huberman is that he, you know, it's as you said, like if you have a really difficult life, demanding life, like say professionally, you should want an easier private life so that there's a respite, you know, somewhere where you go and recharge your batteries and then come back to work, which is a really demanding environment for you. But he doesn't seem to need that. Like he just likes self-sabotaging.
But yeah.
Is he sabotaging? Because
I don't know.
If he really is
well enough, maybe he'd be doing really well if it weren't for this.
So the podcast, I find it to be fascinating. If we can just like shift a little bit away from the article and like this guy, like as he appears to be based on like the podcast he's putting out. Now, again, I don't listen. I haven't listened. Okay. I've read a couple of stuff. I've seen some clips and I've just looked at like browsed through his offerings on his website. So what's crazy about this guy is like his podcast last launched 2021, which is not that long ago, like given the fact that it's like top 10 Apple podcasts.
Yeah,
like,
really?
Even now it's like it's like number 8 or something on Apple. Like he was number 1 at a time at some point, but he's like top 10. That's crazy. You're competing with the New York Times. You're competing with that,
makes me feel extra that one bad crime about podcast
and Joe Rogan. That's huge. Like it really is an incredible feat to achieve in 3 years. You know, like that's unbelievable. Like that's just how do you start from nothing? Like he was just a guest on Joe Rogan's podcast and then that other guy who is boring and has nothing to say.
Lex Friedman?
Yes.
Sarah, don't say that about Lex.
I'm sorry. Okay, no.
We might need him someday. We might need all of these guys. There's a reason.
I'm never going to go on his podcast. He's never going to invite me, so I can just burn that bridge now.
I would be very curious to have Andrew Huberman on our podcast. I would love to hear his side of the story.
I would too.
So if he's hearing this, Andrew, he
has every other opportunity and he's not going to choose us. But hey, we're women. We should tell him that. Like,
I will not go swimming in Venice with you, but
in this water that is so gross.
I hope
they mean like a pool.
If he's
like a private pool, like something beautiful. Like
I mean,
with all
there's
these...
no public pools in Venice, as far as I know, unless they went to like you know the Y. Maybe they went to a you know to the YMCA.
Maybe no. Okay, Venice sucks. I don't know why anyone goes to Venice.
Venice is incredibly expensive and fancy now. Are you kidding? But anyway,
I went to it. I didn't think it was.
Well, do you know how much the real estate is?
It smelled bad.
Blow your mind. Well,
it smelled bad in there. It's the whole place smelled bad.
Yeah.
And what's
lately?
How
it
much?
Does, yeah.
The kitschiness is charming for like 2 hours, but I need something else. You know, and I don't like seafood, so there's.
Okay, but, well, okay. You know what? He's not. You're not. Okay.
I'm not going to go
Andrew has
swimming
no chance with Sarah. But if he's willing
he
to come,
you.
If he's willing to come like a little bit east, you know, where I live, maybe I would
go on a swim.
not a swim, but maybe like a meet at a pond. I bring Hugo. Hugo mm-hmm. can go for a swim while we stand okay. there and watch but him
his,
swim.
So his podcast, it's just how to do this, how to improve this, how to have the best cup of coffee you've ever had in your life. Every morning is perfect. Every second of your life is optimized and every minute is just living it to the fullest. I think this is crazy. Like, I think this is like a, there's something about this approach to life that is in a way admirable. You know, I do admire it. On the other hand, like, I'm not its enemy. I'm not trying to shut them down.
Theoretically, it is.
Theoretically, it's
a good,
you know, good
thing.
For him. I'm not hating. It's just that I think it reflects something psychotic.
Yeah,
about
I was going to say it's
culture.
Psychotic. I think it's psychotic.
But also that he's so popular, which means so many people want this. Like, every day they wake up and they think, how can I improve, you know, yeah. how I meditate and how can I take better showers and. Mm-hmm. You know, what birth control should I take and how can I optimize that? And how can I be the best parent I could possibly
be?
But no, but right. so, but like optimizing everything, everything has is peak performance.
I know. You know what it is? Self. He's like human cocaine.
Mm. Yeah.
It's just
more.
There's no low. Like it's, yeah. I mean, it is. It's like people forget that you cannot experience a high if you don't also experience a low. So everything is like high. Everything
he's
is
promising
just,
you that you right. can only ever, you know, you like expose yourself to light at certain times of the day and the red light goes in and it does this or what. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm actually making up what I think he says, but I feel like it's not healthy. This is not healthy. Is life meant to be optimized? You know,
no,
is that what
I
you
have the
do?
Opposite approach. I de-optimize. I like
I
to do everything the least productive or exciting way possible.
I was thinking I should like launch another Substack or a video series or something, and all of it is just like meditation on how to quit this obsession with optimizing everything and some other way of viewing life. That doesn't just like look at your relationships and your what you eat and your exercise as a thing to make you better, you know, as an instrument to improve you into the best version of you. I mean, it's like Oprah, but bros for bros, you know?
Yeah.
And I just don't.
It's Bropra.
Well, I mean, Bropra was the official Bropra is Joe Rogan.
Okay.
I think.
Oh, did I not just come up with that?
You did not come up with that.
I did not come up with that? Damn.
No. He's been Bropra for a long time. Okay. Yeah. And I don't mean that as an
No, sorry. I just thought, I thought it was yeah. good. No, it's a good little.
It's a good little, it's cute.
What do they call that? What's the word for that? It's on the tip of my tongue when you combine words. Anyway.
But I just don't think this might be very smart, but it doesn't feel wise, you know? It just doesn't feel like these are the kind of things we should be thinking about.
No.
Like, here's a research paper that came out and and
people love that. If it has research paper behind it, if it has neuroscience behind it, if it has, like, there's certain buzzwords.
I think it gives you permission to do something which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Like, to if I can insert science and a study, which, by the way, like some people were pointing out, like they actually had legitimate criticisms of him as like a content producer, and that sometimes he'll share studies that may or may not be, you know, they've had small sample size,
yeah, he
or whatever,
has some quacks
hacking,
on his show,
you know, and
guess.
Some there's quacks here and there, and he might be promoting things that are not extremely, I mean, but he promotes a lot, right? Like, he talks about a lot. So I'm sure just from the perspective of, you can't possibly know all the negatives of everything.
That's also the problem with the content creation world, is because you have to make more content, more. Otherwise you'll fall behind. And so by definition, some of it's going to suck.
Some of it's going to suck. Some of this is going to be stuff you don't know anything about. I mean, and this is this format that he's, and what he's doing, optimizing this, optimizing that. So you have this expert who's going to tell you the best way to, you know, smoke a cigarette or whatever, you know, and.
I would actually, that I'd sign up for. I'd like to know the absolute best way to smoke a cigarette.
Isn't it? Like, there are people who use nicotine as like a, nootropic or whatever.
Well, not nootropic. By smoking cigarettes.
Right, right. Okay. But the point, I think that, so he has an expert on, he looks a little bit up, you know, what they're talking about. He has like a very amateur, like understanding of that. He can't possibly have a deep enough understanding to be able to shut them down if they're talking nonsense.
I know.
Right?
See, here, like, I know. The problem though is like, it, yeah, we have all these sort of, you know, potential quacks and kind of half-baked experts floating around the independent media sphere. But like, quote unquote, actual scholars are not reliable necessarily anymore either. So I don't know what to do. Like, I don't want to be like, oh, well,
we
can't
be wrong, right?
They could be wrong. And like a peer review, like, okay, peer reviewed. That doesn't mean anything now. Like, we could sit here and be like, oh, Andrew Huberman shouldn't have had, you know, talked about this paper because it wasn't peer reviewed. Well, guess what? All that, then you're sounding like all the gender activists who are constantly talking about peer reviewed papers because the peers that review those things are their peers who are activists. Like, it's a total mess.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who to believe.
It's a mess. But I mean, I think that some of my unease in just like general like news reporting can kind of apply to this, in that if somebody was running a column, a science column for a major magazine, and every week they wrote about another topic and just like a topic that is actually rich. Like, there's a lot to know, a lot to understand, a lot of science, and they distilled something from it and wrote a little piece. I would think that, well, you can't possibly know what you're talking about. Like, you can't
But in the past, they would have had an editor, and again, it would.
I know
been
we've
fact
talked about
checked,
this, but I don't know if the fact checker editor works if someone's wrong. Like, say, like the Amy Cuddy thing about power posing, right? Like, mm-hmm. You had studies, they seem to be strong at the time, you know, the later it was right. Like, oh no, maybe not, but at the time it was passing the fact checks. It's there's so many things that turn out to be not true that pass the fact checks, because it is not a perfect system. It relies on, you know, the methods themselves of fact checking to be sufficient,
right? Well,
this
is like a
often.
Replication crisis kind of thing,
right? Yeah. and then what are you left with? You know, and
yeah, that's the problem. But I mean, obviously, like Amy Cuddy's power pose, that was catnip for media. That's exactly the kind of thing that magazines love and the columnists love. And that, you know, that didn't do a lot of damage. I mean, is there any, that's just kind of,
there was a bunch
sort
of stuff though,
corporate,
that you know, over
trend.
The years,
yeah, no,
I've
there's
seen
a lot
of, it just,
yes,
you know,
for sure.
pile up. Like, oh, it turns out like Dunning-Kruger,
yeah, well,
maybe
study,
might not have been a real thing. It's like,
and health studies, you know, what I mean, nutrition is just like a complete free for
all.
All
the
changes
time.
Constantly.
But he must know this.
Yeah, look, I think everybody is just so desperate to stay afloat in this economy that they will do what's necessary. And also audience capture. If
Maybe
everyone's
he believes
just
it too.
Saying,
you know, like,
go,
he
bro.
Just believes it. That
yeah,
that
you end
is...
up believing your own press. So that's, I know. I mean, again, it always comes down to this. So yes, portmanteau was the word I was thinking of. Like the bropra, when you combine two words to make a new word. Portmanteau.
Next time. Oh, but you know, I just feel like it's a recipe to be misled. But I agree with you that it's not even about what it claims to be about. It's not about self-help. It's about feeling like you're helping yourself. You know, it's about consuming something that is actually just enjoyable.
Yeah, and it's also about thinking about yourself constantly.
Yeah, and
I mean,
as an object to be improved.
Yeah, and I hate to sound like, you know, church lady or state the obvious, but if you are of service and do things for other people, you will feel so much better. Like, that mm-hmm. is just like the fastest way to feel better.
Yep. Yep. No, I'm with you there 100%. I mean, I think that this is he is very much a product of our culture. You know, he's not counterculture, even though it seems like people are mad at him. The kinds of people that are mad at him are the kinds of people who tend to be mad at, you know, counterculture currents.
Well, he codes right wing. He looks like a right winger, but I'm trying to figure out why. Is it because he's like muscle man jacked, and is it the beard? Like,
I've been thinking
he has
too,
an aesthetic.
Yeah.
He has an aesthetic that sets people off. I mean, if Chris
Masculine.
Hayes, okay, if Chris Hayes or Michael Barbaro
yeah.
were caught behaving this way in their personal lives, I wonder what would happen. Like, how come we have never seen any takedowns of left-wing mainstream media heroes? I mean, have we? Am I missing somebody?
There must be so many of them that have the same.
Of course. Like,
there must be so many that have the same kind of thing going on.
I guess we had like the Me Too guys. I mean, Matt Lauer was not that. That was a Me Too case. That was like a pretty clear cut Me Too case. There was not a political valence on that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just being.
This is not even Me Too, though. You know what I mean? Like, don't even think we have the. I don't think we have that same energy in the air anymore that we're just trying to pick up anybody and smear them. So you're right. I was thinking about it too. Like, what makes him a target? You know, why was he?
Because he goes on Joe Rogan and he's a YouTuber.
Yeah, I think he's male. That's what it is. And he codes as male. Like, in, you know, Michael Barbaro.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't code the same way. You know, like I think that's what it is. Like, they code kind of feminine.
Well, they're effete. It has the whole NPR
vibe,
sort of,
yeah.
You know, like, breathless.
Harmless.
Aesthetic.
Harmless. Harmlessness.
Yeah, but you know, they sound like Ira Glass. I mean, yeah. You know, they have that sound. And it's very soothing.
He is threatening, though. He has a different vibe about him. And same with Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan especially, I think, he has a vibe of, I can hurt you. I'm not harmless. And I think that there's something about that's offensive. I also wonder if it's deeper than this, you know, because it's, I think there's something about, you know, our culture that makes us so fascinated with ourselves and, you know, and building up ourselves or whatever, or building up our own sense of self. And, you know, there's two opposing ways I think you can approach this, this modern desire of to build an identity. You can either go the improver optimizer route of Huberman, or you can kind of do this, you know, the Emily Gould thing, where you're not optimizing at all, and you're just sort of looking at yourself being yourself and analyzing that and writing about it, and, you know, and it's not.
Yeah. I wonder, is that the female analog to the optimizer? Are there any female optimizers? I mean, I guess there's the Gwyneth Paltrow. There's like the Goop thing, right?
Yeah. But there's so much of that is Cope. At least half of Goop is Cope. That's the thing. Like,
you don't think Huberman has a element of Cope?
Where's at least the Cope? An element. I mean,
there's a Cope in everything.
There's a little bit of element. There's a little bit of Cope and a little bit of optimization in just about anything except the extremes. But I think with Huberman, it's the underlying message is actually you're responsible for your life and you can make things better by acting differently, which is very much opposed to the underlying message of, like, kind of the lady writers of, like, my life is chaotic and I ripped apart.
Right, right. I'm a victim of the system.
Yeah,
systemic.
And I blew up my family because I wasn't being, you know, like, I didn't, mm-hmm. some itch wasn't being scratched and I wasn't being fulfilled in this way. And so, you know, they talk about themselves as if they cannot stop themselves, like, as if they do not have autonomy in their own bodies, as if it's just happening. You know,
it's so interesting because a lot of these brofluencers, they also say that they love stoicism, mm-hmm. but what they're doing is the opposite of stoicism, because stoicism is about, like, being able to separate what you can control from what you can't, like, mm-hmm. you know, the being able to distinguish those two things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could use a little infusion of actual stoicism, I think. I think that they sort of think that stoicism is just, like, not complaining, which mm-hmm. is great. All for that.
And emotional control.
Yeah, really. But you just, like, you know, the narcissism of thinking that you can control everything is very anti-stoic. But wait, how is Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop cope?
I haven't looked into Goop in a long time, so I might be totally wrong about this. So I don't want to go into it too.
No, but I don't know. I was never a Goop aficionado, but, like, where's the Cope there?
I don't remember. I remember some weird vagina stone stuff. I guess that's not Cope.
Oh yeah, yeah. But the vagina scented candle.
There was
that's
some
Cope.
I can't remember. I can't remember. You're right. She might be a female optimizer.
I mean, I think she's, that's just like,
does she still do Goop is still real?
I think so. Real? I mean, that's just knowing like where the money is. The sort of,
I thought it was
wellness.
Kind of like a lifestyle thing.
Yeah, it's
like
a Goop wellness is just brand. Lifestyle yeah. wellness brand. But I don't know where the Cope would be there.
Okay, you're right. I don't think that's Cope.
Yeah.
But I do think Emily Gould is Cope. Something about her is Cope.
I mean, ever since I started hearing you talk about Cope, I'm so curious about it. And I think about it all the time.
Like, it's not as if she's necessarily coping. It's that she provides you, she gives you permission to cope. You know, she gives you, she lowers the this threshold, spectrum yes. of
it's allow, cope, allowable cope is attainable.
Right. And well, she, yeah, exactly. She pushes it pretty far. And so you are allowed to be a little bit better than her, still bad, but a little bit better than her. And at least you can say, I'm not like that. And
oh, I see.
So it yeah. just, I think she allows you, she allows you to forgive yourself or something, you know, like that there's an element of, at least I'm not that. And I think there's something about that, something about the struggle against norms that women, for some reason, like those sort of kind of social campaigns that women tend to make up like a good portion of, that something about it feels as if it is, they're acting in it because they do not want to be judged when it comes time for them to like go outside yeah. the norm or well, fuck yeah. up in some way, you know?
Yeah.
It's a bizarre kind of involvement in a politics that is actually just very, it's very inward focused, not even about the politics.
No, it's like very schoolyard mean girl. It's like, it's all preserving your position in the group, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very female.
There's something so female about it. And then yeah. there's something so masculine about what he's doing, even though it is also, you know, deranged and, as you said, like a little narcissistic. There's whiffs of that. There's something
I think
healthy
it's extremely
too.
Narcissistic. I think it's a little psychotic. Narcissistic,
I think
for
it's
sure.
Pretty psychotic.
There's some sprinkles of psychotic.
A little delusional. Yeah. Like it is. There is that sense of like, I mean, there's no way where you're going to have the perfect poop. Like, what are you doing? Like, cannot live your life this way. I don't understand it. But maybe, you know, maybe that's because I'm a woman and I don't get it. I don't have that kind of energy.
All of our poops are perfect if we're women. They're all beautiful. All poops are political when you're a woman.
There's a whole section on his like website about gut bacteria. Maybe.
Yeah, they like a lot of people like gut bacteria discourse.
I kind of do too. I get it. Popular. I think there's
well,
probably
I know, you've
something
got there. Your how's your squatty potty going? Or I'm sorry, your bidets. You're not
oh, my bidets. Yeah. Yeah. They're yeah, I've made peace with them. I've come
oh,
to know them.
You were
yeah.
so excited in the beginning. Was there did the honeymoon end at a certain point?
No. I was first scared because I just didn't understand there were all these buttons on the you know, on the you get a remote and there's all this stuff that it's going to do.
It's on your
and
phone.
Like, whoa,
is it a phone
like,
app? You have to bring your phone in
separate,
so you can flush the toilet.
I wonder, some of them must be app related, but mine is not. Mine is just a remote. There's a remote.
That's
it,
worse because you're
going to
lose
of stuff.
It. Oh.
I mean, no, well, you dock it in a little thing and it can do so much. And it freaked me out because I just didn't want to have, you know, I was like, okay, what if it blows my bits off something, you know, like I don't know what I don't know what it's capable of and I'm not
yeah does it have like airplane happy. Flush mode
no it has it does have a drying though it can do all yeah. kinds of different like water pressure move around there's like settings user one user two it's all kind it's like crazy it's crazy and I was scared of it for a really long time and then I tried it and I was like this is amazing this is the best thing that's ever happened to me
ever
now we're,
really like better than meeting your husband better than doing this podcast better than
my husband installed it so I think my husband is still for the first
okay
and then maybe this yeah
wow.
It's
all right well I mean but the problem is we know what's going to happen which is that child is going to get a hold of the remote and
oh my
it
god
will be
I'm so
missing
scared.
Forever
I'm so what is gonna happen what is he gonna do Nothing. I don't know.
Gonna take it to preschool. He's gonna be like messing around with it. You're gonna find out what the range is on the remote. You're gonna be sitting there, and suddenly the thing's going crazy because he's like screwing around with it miles away.
But what
in
I mean,
daycare.
There's a beautiful future here. You know, like we're gonna have toilets that tell us how healthy we are, they're going to analyze what goes in and they're going to give you smart a little toilets. Printout. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, they're going to tell you, I don't know about what you just ate.
Yeah.
I don't know about it. I don't
that's
think it was
I need, that's what I
good
need
for you. You should toss out the yeah the leftovers because okay. that wasn't
good. I'm always looking for more more places to be judged. So that's good to hear. Well, speaking of which, I know we've been going a while, so we're not going to take too long on this, but I do want to talk about another New York Magazine article.
They're killing it. Just I mean, they're yesterday. Really, they're killing me.
I love it. So this is a piece about age gap discourse. It is part of the age gap discourse. It is called The Case for Marrying an Older Man by Grazie Sofia Christi, a writer I had not heard of, but I have since read a few other things by her. And it is an essay about how she... she went to Harvard. She grew up in Miami. She's like a very educated, upper middle class girl. She noticed when she was in college that her classmates were dating guys their own age, and these guys weren't so great, and they had a certain type, and she felt that she wasn't this type. And so one day she just decided to flirt with a graduate student 10 years older. And they ended up getting married, and she's in a relationship with somebody 10 years older. And she thinks that this is the ultimate life hack. Mm. And she thinks everybody should do this. I have many thoughts about this piece, mm-hmm. which I can say, but do you have anything to say first?
You thought you weren't an age. You thought I would like it.
I thought you, you know what?
I agree with her.
I thought you
She's 27.
I thought
She's
you wrote
baby.
It. I thought that you wrote it, that you had taken on Grazie Sofia Christi as your pseudonym.
That's a crazy
name. That's good.
Is that a real name, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think she's Cuban American, maybe. I don't know.
She calls her husband her mentor.
Okay.
I don't know.
I mean, that's a cute nickname. It's better than my abuser, as nicknames go. Just saying.
Yes, it is better. I thought the writing was good. This was a good written piece. This is the kind of piece that I would never. I don't gravitate towards.
I know you hate.
I just
this
don't
kind
care
of thing.
About somebody how somebody else is organizing their life. Okay, we're talking about it. There are things that are relevant to the culture, so we're talking about it. I think it's a really bizarre thing for someone who is 27 to say, this is amazing. This is the best life I've ever had. You know, like mm-hmm. this is the life hack. Because she is in the state, she's in the part of an age gap relationship in which everything is great.
It really is optimal. Like, because neither of them are old. First of all, it's only 10 years. That's not a very big age gap.
That's not even a real age gap, I think. I think 15 plus is when, like, the real problem.
I mean, it does feel... Okay, I mean, when you were... Well, I mean, you were...
10 is older. 10 is older. 10 is definitely age gap.
When I was 22, I dated somebody 30, so mm-hmm. 8 years older for a couple of years, and I felt like it was kind of older. Mm-hmm. I felt it was...
Oh, yeah,
you could You could feel... You could mind the gap. You would mind the gap for sure.
Yeah, because I think you can give men anywhere from 3 to 4 years, maybe 3 to 5 years, depending on maturity level. And that gap is fine because you're actually evenly matched, because I think women mature faster for a while anyway. And so if you're 22 and you're dating like a 25 to 27-year-old, that's okay. Mm-hmm. After that, it's going to be a gap, probably. Because if he's normally
especially
developing,
because you have no life experience. I mean, this person has been in the world.
That's a big thing.
They went to college.
She's enjoying it. She's enjoying that he's bringing.
Well, also
her
he's
into
really rich. We should say he's really rich and he's French.
So that's okay. The other thing she didn't say. The case for marrying an older, wealthy man.
Right.
I don't even think you need to make that case, though. That's the case you don't need to make, and then you wouldn't get an opportunity to write for the cut, mm-hmm. because everyone gets it. I like the way that she's approaching this, which is, it's kind of a everyone tells you not to, you know, just optimize on the fact that you are a young woman and you're beautiful and you can have this like easy life when you marry an older man. He can take care of you. Things don't have to be so hard. You don't have to be both, you know, the beautiful young thing working out all the time. Also have the babies, also have a job and a career. You don't have to, the pressure is not as intense to do that because he can provide. Again, this is presuming he has a good job. So, okay. But again, this is the time in your life where an age gap relationship is only positives for the woman anyway. It will be when he dies way before her, leaving her a young widow, that the negatives of marrying, the case for marrying an older man might show up. Or he just gets gross. You know what I mean? Like, there's a point at which you just get gross. Like, you can't fight age. You're cute for a while. And then, you know, like, the collagen, it starts going away. Yes, men age better for a while. But then, you know, it gets you. At some point, it gets you. And then she won't want to have sex. Yeah, nose hair, ear hairs, you know, the eyebrow thing, like, coming out like that.
Yeah,
like,
what is with that?
I don't know.
I'd like Andrew Huberman to explain the cellular... the cellular process.
They're antenna.
Of getting nose
they
hair.
Are like they're routing something, but you know, I think that that kind of like sexual disgust might show up later in life. You know, I mean, these are all maze, might not actually happen, which is why I just think it's bizarre for somebody so young to be like, this is amazing and everyone should do it. It's like, okay, like I can see how for you at this point in time, this is great and there's nothing but benefits. But you might feel differently 40 years from now, 50 years from now, you know. So I don't think that it is. I would never say this, you know. I would never write this. I would never write this piece, even though that's the same choice I made. But I wouldn't. I don't approach it this way at all. And it's not so transactional. Although I understand the kind of cold logic that she's bringing, and I do appreciate it. You know, I think that this like super, this is going to be my partner, my romantic, you know, equal, and we're going to be deeply in love forever, you know, like I think that romantic relationships are transactional if you're trying to build a family, you know. If like if you're there,
no, they're trans. I mean, there's everything's transactional in some way.
Everything's
or other.
Transactional, yeah, yeah. But friendships can be just purely we just enjoy each other's company. You know, that's a smarter thing to do with friends, you know, than it is necessarily with your partner, because they actually have to have a lot of other qualities too. Like you should like to spend time with them. You should also be able to depend on them. They must also be trustworthy and have a set of things that they're bringing to the table that complement your things. You know. So I think that given that there's work to be done in a marriage where you want to reproduce, given that there's a goal, family, you know, and setting up a household and taking care of those kids, like given that there's a product, if you would just want to call those children product, and you want to get to that.
Well, there's a project.
Project, yeah. You're, there's a project that you're working on together. And just like in a colleague, you wouldn't, it shouldn't just be somebody you like to have a chat with. It should just, there should be a lot more going on. I appreciate that she has sort of this frank discussion of what this older man brings to the table and the fact that she is young and she's only going to be young for a short period of time. And she wants to capitalize.
She optimized. Look, yeah, she's an optimizer. This is a perfect example.
That's how she thinks of it, you know, at this point in time anyway.
People are really, really harshing on her writing and on the piece itself. I do think it's a bit of a, it's all over the place, but I think she gets at some really, really interesting concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's actually a great writer. I mean, there's just like,
you love all writers. You're always like, I love this writer.
No, I am not. No, I am not. Most writers are terrible, especially the most famous and highly paid ones. But I mean, just the way she describes being in college. Okay, so she's at Harvard. She says, I resented the callow boys in my class who lusted after a particular socially sanctioned type on campus, thin and sexless, emotionally detached and socially connected, the opposite of me. Woo! There's so much going on in that sentence. And it all, and it's so much of it has to do with class and, you know, sort of regional, the trappings of like certain like, you know, socioeconomic, social circles. Like, I mean, I totally know what she's talking about. Like in those kinds of Ivy League schools, that kind of sort of androgynous, ironically kind of European, that kind of like thin and sexless, emotionally detached and socially connected. I felt like that when I was in college, that was the currency for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. Like if you checked all of those boxes, you were hot and desirable. And it sounds like what she's saying is that she, I mean, I don't know what she looked like at the time, but that she just had a different kind of aesthetic. And she felt like she couldn't compete. So she changed the, you know, she decided she was going to go after a different audience. And that was, you know, in this case, she's trying to make the case that that audience was an older guy. But I think, you know, something else was going on. But I mean, I'm really interested in this concept of the dynamic between, say, a 24-year-old girl and her 24-year-old boyfriend. Like, who has their act more together? And what does that mean? Like, who is learning what from whom? Like, so there's a, just read a little bit here. So she says, at 20, I felt daunted by the project of becoming my ideal self. Couldn't imagine doing it in tandem with someone. Two raw lumps of clay trying to mold one another and only sullying things worse. I'd go on dates with boys my age and leave with the impression that they were telling me not about themselves, but some person who didn't exist yet and on whom I was meant to bet regardless. Okay. My husband struck me instead as so finished formed, analyzable for compatibility. He bore the traces of other women who'd improved him. Small but crucial basics. Like, use a coaster. Listen, don't give advice. Young egos mellow into patience and generosity. Well, for, if a guy doesn't use a coaster, okay, that's a deal breaker. We're done.
Use a coaster. Shit. Like, I have like wood, like tabletops.
You've got
everywhere.
A lot of rings. You've got water rings on your, yeah. So yeah. If I see that, it's game over. But okay, so seriously, I'm very interested in that idea, and I'm also interested in something that she didn't get at, maybe because she can't see it, which is that like when you're a young woman dating an older man, he has intrinsic value just because of his age. He could still be a complete loser, but because he has years on you, he's still going to offer you some
really,
value.
Like if he was as broke as the 22-year-old, you would still think that just because he's older,
yes,
he has values.
Oh, yes.
I think older losers are worse.
Yeah, but older
guys.
Losers. Okay, let's not.
I would just
find, use the word loser, even
no,
though
but
I
if
used
I
it.
Was 22, and then I found a guy that was 35 or whatever, and then he was just as broke as me at 22.
But what if he, well, broke in what way? Like maybe he's an artist. Maybe he, you know, he,
I don't get
look,
it.
If no. We're in New York City,
again,
and he has his own
I'm
apartment.
I'm optimizing for a project.
He doesn't
so
have roommates.
If he's an artist, he's disqualifying himself.
Okay. But if he, okay, for, okay, well,
I don't think age.
I see what you're saying.
I think age itself, in itself, is not. It's an amplifier in a way, but it is not in itself all that important. It just it can get by that time they have proven themselves, and I like that sentence of hers actually that this idea that we should take a bet on somebody. Mm-hmm. This is the male equivalent of women saying that a man should love me for more than my looks. Like he should value me for me. And what does it matter if I gain 50 pounds? You know, like those women are kind of living in this idealized society, which I agree with them that I think that it would be better.
Yes,
if
it would be.
It would
it's
be
a naturalistic
be
fallacy.
It would be,
it
better,
would be better,
but it isn't
but
that
it's
way.
Not.
And you shouldn't punish an animal for being an animal. Okay. And I think we forget sometimes that we do have urges that are not entirely in our control, that we have to battle all the time, you know, and be like more decent human beings. And it is okay to just accept that you're a human person and you're an animal and you have a drive, you have a desire to find a certain kind of mate. And it's okay to just, you know, like, I think it's okay if a woman is optimizing her appearance in a way that, like, I remember I said this to somebody, like, they were like, what kind of style do you like? What do you kind of like? What kind of, what's your personal style? And I was like, you know what? I just do whatever I think my husband's going to like. And they were like, I could tell that their impression of me was like, oh, you're just like an idiot who's being led around by some man. And from my perspective, it was, well, I'm not looking at me, you know, like he's the one that's got to look at me all the time. And it is in my favor that he is attractive, that it is easy for him to be a good partner to me because he's also attracted to me. So why wouldn't I just, you know,
I don't believe that you choose your clothes solely because based on what your husband would like. You have a sense of style. You have a look that appeals to you. No,
it is one of the, I feel like there are many different styles that I could see myself. You know, I had a very different style when I met my husband, actually. He didn't like it.
Wow. See, this so is I was it. Just this like, okay, is, well, okay, well, that's a
I
very,
like this guy. If he likes that's it, you know,
it's interesting.
Dolly Parton
example.
Said this. Dolly Parton, like, people are like, why do you, anytime she's asked, why do you do all this? She's like, my husband likes it and I love him. So I do it.
Wow.
And
it's, that's
and I'm like, that's, you know what?
Okay.
She is,
I don't, that's
she's got
lie.
It all figured out because it's, it is, I think it is more bizarre to say that, you know, my outward appearance needs to express some kind of creative impulse that is inside, and that this is how I do it. This is
not
how
a
I express
creative
myself.
Impulse, but it's a, yeah, I think it's, you know, a personal taste.
But that's, you can have love that's it. Like, so let's say you have, there's like five different styles that you like, you know, and maybe one is super appealing to you, but another is super appealing to your partner. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you just pick the one that's, you know, like, say you have a preppy style, you like it, or there's more of a like glam style and your husband prefers that. So why wouldn't you just like sort of shift?
God,
over
I can't see. This is a very telling example of the difference between partnering with somebody young versus spending many years on your own, because I can't even conceive of that. Like, I think of my personal style, whatever that means, like it goes through phases, you know? I mean, you see yourself as a particular kind of way for a while. And then, you know,
I
remember, like, I realized it was like a huge revelation to me when I realized that just because I liked the way a piece of clothing looked didn't mean that I was going to like the way it looked on me. Like, that was a difference. Like, I can be like, oh my God, I love this designer, or I love this style, or whatever. Yeah, yeah. And that is a separate thing from whether or not it's going to look good on me. And that's, I think so, that's like one of those.
There's another thing.
Maturity.
There's another addition to that, which is, what I like, what I think looks good on me, what my husband thinks looks good on me. Those are actually different. And it's bizarre to me sometimes what he thinks looks horrible on me. And I'll be like, what? This is amazing. And he's like, well, you hate it. And then it's not as if he's going to put me out on the curb if I dress the way I wanted to dress. Like, it's not even a big favor. It's not even a big deal to me, you know, because I just don't. I don't see it as a big sacrifice. I don't see it as a, I see my appearance as something for other people to consume, you know, and it doesn't actually reflect much about me. I do a good job about just gabbing away all the time. People know who I am by what I say, you know, and that's sufficient.
But you, for instance, like, you wouldn't cut your hair. You like your hair. It's important to you. It's a big part of your, you know, self.
Okay. If husband's out the picture, I'm single woman, I don't care anymore, I'm, you know, I'm in a position where I don't want a partner ever again, or it doesn't matter. Like, other people finding me sexually attractive is irrelevant now. You know, suddenly it's taken away. It's gone. Then I would just chop it all off. It's so in.
No, you wouldn't.
What? It's crazy.
No, you would not.
Yes, I would.
You clearly enjoy your hair. It doesn't have to do with other people.
Because, yes, it does. Yes, it does. It 100% does. Because if other people didn't like it, why would I, like, it's just hair. It's
no, I can't. I don't believe this. It makes you feel good. It's part of you.
Because other people like it.
No.
But if other people
have nothing to do with it. You are selling yourself short. I'm not going to allow this.
I'm not selling myself short. You're saying that I'm selling myself short because you see it as a negative thing to do that. But
no,
I don't see it as a negative.
I see it. I see that you're being honest. I just don't.
No. So,
okay.
So, like, say, imagine as if you know, like, how do I put this? But like, I remember I had a conversation with a woman for like 2 seconds, like this friend of a friend kind of person. She was sitting there, I remember, and she looked different. And I was like, what's wrong with her? What's different? And then I realized she got a boob job and they were huge, you know? And then they were odd, actually. They didn't look good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they were like a little too big.
Yeah.
But they were big, you know? And she used to have nothing. She used to be totally flat and now she had boobs. And maybe it was just like early days because she had just gotten them. So they might have settled into something more normal looking. But I remember, like, you know, she just wanted to let, like, obviously you notice, you know. And she said one of these phrases that I find to be so deeply bizarre. Like, I did it for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like she just had to tell me that she did it for herself.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, what does that mean? What are you talking about? Are you saying that if you're the last woman on earth, you're the last person on earth, no one exists, you would still have gotten that boob job? Of course you wouldn't have. Like, of course there's an image you want reflected, you know, for whatever reason. Maybe it's because you want to be seen as tasteful or whatever, or sexually available or attractive or whatever. There's some image you're trying to send, some message you're trying to send to others. And that is the purpose of your appearance. And that is why you did it. You did it for others. And like, you did it because you want others to feel a certain way.
Okay, I mean,
this
is getting a little metaphysical, what doing it for me means. Does she have a partner? Did she have a boyfriend or a husband? Because a lot of men don't want women to get like boob jobs, for instance. It often is the woman who wants it and the guy. I mean, it obviously.
I mean,
varies,
I think a guy wouldn't tell you even if he did. You know, if he didn't.
Some guys are like, I'll pay for it. I mean, there's
right,
that.
Right. But I mean, if you're a decent dude and you would maybe you would a little bit prefer it, you still wouldn't say it because that would destroy your girlfriend and wife who you love anyway. You know, that would destroy her. You know, sense of self. So you would never say that. But I keeping that aside, I just feel like you don't, it is outrageous that someone can be telling themselves this. I did this for me, this very obvious cue of sexuality that men just happen to prefer. I mean, it's not arbitrary. What you did wasn't arbitrary. It fit a mold, you know, like, and I don't know. I just feel like I don't enjoy the lie, and I don't enjoy partially because it makes whatever it is that you're actually doing it for harder to get anyway, if you're lying to yourself about it, because then you go an odd way around to prove to yourself that you did it for you.
Well, but you're speaking about this on a very abstract level, which I actually appreciate. I am following you, but I feel like I'm going to say something just totally obvious, but I think that they actually connect. It's like, okay, but if you feel better, if you get a boob job and you feel sexier, regardless of whether the reason you feel sexy is because the patriarchy, et cetera, if you feel sexier, you probably are more likely to attract somebody because you feel hotter and you carry yourself in a different way.
Right. But it's discursive. I mean, that's kind of circular because it depends on what you think other people find attractive in the first place. If you thought that it would not elevate you at all or make you sexier, you wouldn't be more confident, even if it did make you sexier.
No, right. I mean, this is right. Unless we are totally disembodied brains in jars.
Yeah, so a lot of women think that weight gain makes them, they feel really bad about weight gain. But in reality, men don't mind it as much. And super skinniness, men mind more than just like a little bit, just like a little bit of like,
oh yeah,
chunk, you know. That's a good example of like the division between what you think people want, and so you feel a certain way about yourself, versus what they actually do want, you know. But if you keep saying I'm just doing it for me anyway, you know, I think that that's just, it takes it into this realm of like, I'm, you know, this is my book cover, basically. But don't judge me by my cover, but actually do judge me because it does represent me. It's my personal style and it says something about who I am. So, okay. All right.
Okay.
All
right. So you dress for your husband is what you're saying. Fine.
I mean, you're giving signals, right? Like, I mean, you don't want to come across like a crazy person.
What if your husband wanted you to dress in clown outfits?
I probably wouldn't do like a full, like Dolly Parton is actually an extreme example of something I probably wouldn't do. Like that's too much. And I, even if he found that attractive, I just couldn't
What if he said that? What if he was like, you know what? I realize I'm a clown fetishist. I want you to wear face paint and big shoes.
Maybe we get divorced.
Rainbow wig. And I want you to have a horn on your nose. And I want you to go around like that. Yeah.
I mean, okay. It's not as if I would do anything exactly like whatever he says I do. It's out of the things I already like. I don't mind just sort of leaning towards what he likes as opposed to like my favorite thing, because I'm not looking at me. I'm just not doing it. So what's the, I don't know. I just don't see the point of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I've had this conversation a couple of times actually, like. And people are always like, oh, you're saying you're like just mindless. Oh,
I get it, but it's like you did not,
over to whatever.
You were not, you did not have like, you know, years to sort of like, you know, try out different things. And I mean, that's the thing about being, okay, like, you know, you met your husband, you were very young. Like, so what you don't have, for better or for worse, maybe you're lucky not to have this, but like, you know, these years where you're sort of like, figuring out, am I the kind of person that would wear this? Am I the kind of person who would like do this kind of thing?
Is that something you're figuring out, or is that something you're building?
Well,
are you discovering
it's
yourself
both.
Or are you creating yourself?
But it's both. Well, right. I mean, it's one of the great things about being older is that you don't walk past a clothing store and look in it and say like, oh my gosh, I love that. Am I the kind of person that can wear that? Should I do that? Am I this? Should I try to be this? It's like, no, either yes or no, probably not.
I think I do that. Am I the kind of person who would wear that? I don't think.
Well,
I
like maybe
think that.
That's me. Maybe this is my future. I mean, and that's the thing with dating too. It's like when you're young and you are, you know, dating somebody, you don't know enough about yourself. You're like, well, maybe I am the kind. This guy is like a total outdoorsman and he spends every weekend camping. Maybe I'm a camping person. Maybe I could have a camping life. Maybe that's what we're going to do. And you try that out for a little while and you realize you don't like it. Or you do.
I don't think I put it in myself into like a, I'm the kind of person who dresses like this. I don't think I ever thought about it that way. I think I generally just think, is it nice, is it not nice? And then there's this added element of, does my husband like it or does he not like it? And there, that's it.
I think
it
comes down
budget?
To your lack
is
of internal
comfort?
Monologue. Maybe it's a piece of that.
Yeah, because I'm not telling myself who I am. I don't know what
you're not
means.
Having like an idea, like this is I the sort of like mental vision board for your life. Like when I look at the future, when I think of my future self, this is what I see.
Yeah, I don't know what I mean, like now that you've said it, you've conjured up something in my mind, right? Like, and I think that it would be cool to like once you're like, you know, there's those like TikToks and YouTube channels where they just have these old bats and like really old women in like metropolitan areas, New York, and like very fashionable areas, and they're just doing all the kinds of crazy experiments and, you know, dressed up wild,
like
fun
Irish,
ways.
Apvel, whatever her name is, who just died with the with the huge glasses. Yeah.
Yeah. They're just like, they're just playing, you know, they're just having this, like, they are using their bodies as like kind of a creative, you know, just
canvas.
Yeah. And I think that's great. That's a way of going about it. I think that's legitimate, you know, and I think that would make sense, more sense for me when I'm past the point at which, you know, I don't want my husband to think of me as a clown. So like once that's over, once he's dead, like, you know, I'll shave off my hair and dress like a clown. Finally.
Yeah. Well, okay. I feel like there's more to say about age gap.
Oh my gosh, there is though. But
I do. I know we've been going for a while. I do. I really am totally fascinated by this thing though. Like the idea that, because like, I mean, when I, because I can't complain, you know, it's funny because I cannot complain about like men my age dating much younger women, because when I was younger, I did it. I did not date anybody 20 years older. No, I did not. But, you know, 11, 12, 13, that kind of thing. And I have no doubt that, you know, even, and these were not like rich moguls. These were, you know, in some cases, like quite eccentric men. And you know, I have no doubt that I was getting something out of it that I that would have had a lot less value, or that just wouldn't have mattered if I had been this person's age. Like that, if I was when I was 30 and dating a 43-year-old, mm-hmm. the female contemporaries of that 43-year-old were probably sort of rolling their eyes or like, okay, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I was getting something out of it just because I'm this person has wisdom and they've read books and they know things that I don't know. And like mm-hmm. they are adding value
right.
in a way.
Yeah.
That, but they are not, but so I do think that
they're adding like, that value is in a way that is about. A traditionally male way to add value too. Like, well, you know, like in the sense that,
not always,
I mean, but, of course, yeah. women can do it too. Everybody doing everything is great, but like that a woman brings in, just like if you're just pure down to biology, mm-hmm. a woman has her youth, her eggs, her ability to reproduce and mother and be nurturing or whatever. And a man has the ability to provide for that family, you know? So just from on that pure perspective, of course, it's not just that. Of course. Like all these other things. But I just don't think you should hate women for wanting somebody to give them that sense of security and safety, which is like buried deep in us to desire that, you know, and to desire a partner that can really pull his weight and not just pull his weight, maybe pull the whole family along if necessary, given how difficult and painful the bearing children can be, you know, and especially if they're young. And what if there's somebody disabled, and what if you get disabled? And, you know, you really want somebody who can provide and provide by themselves. That's not, I don't think men should hate women for wanting that. I think that it really, both sides of the discourse frustrate me. Like it frustrates me that women hate on men for liking younger women who are, you know, like youthful, whatever, you know, especially when they're getting on and cannot provide them with a family anymore. And men for hating that women desire, you know, a certain level of stability. That's how about we just don't hate each other for being like human animals and everybody work on being better about it, you know, and being fairer about it as much as possible. But the comments were really messed up. The comments were like mm-hmm. just pretending as if she made no good points, as if she has just only made the worst decision possible.
It's the editing. I mean, it's one of these pieces. She's 27. I had so many pieces like this when I was young. I had this like really like weird kind of funky, subtle point, cool mm-hmm. kind of perspective I was trying to get across, but I didn't have the chops to like articulate it clearly enough. And if an editor doesn't, you know, kick you around the block a few times, it's not going to work. I would
commend doing something interesting here, yeah.
to people a piece by Grazie Sofia Christi that was in The Point magazine last summer about the Ferrante novels. It's called My Beautiful Friend, Envy as a Way of Life. It has to do with her own appearance, her relationship to her appearance. Mm. And a much more beautiful friend, you know, a beautiful friend. And she talks about the Elena Ferrante novels and the, you know, the two girls, Linu and Lila. And, you know, of course, like that's all about their differences. And one's beautiful and the other's, you know, hardworking, et cetera. And this is a fantastic piece. Beautifully written.
I like this piece though as well. I like
the this piece is a mess. I mean, look, this piece. I understand that you know why people are confused. It needs. I wish that I could like. This is the kind of piece that like if she were a student in my class, I would just be so delighted to work on it. But I think there are flashes of brilliance here, and there's she's clearly a great stylist. Sure. So I'm pissed off at all these people who are like, she's a terrible writer. This is terrible. This is incompetent, et cetera, et cetera. No, not true at all. No, I reject that.
No, I think she's a good writer and she's a good thinker. She makes some interesting points that I don't think mm-hmm. are seen as often. I think she's honest about herself in a way that is rare. Mm-hmm. And having said that, yeah, 27, you know, I'll just say it again. Like, you don't know, this is the case for marrying an older man has not yet been made. Okay. You're 27. You don't know that, you know, I've done it, but I don't go around talking about it because I don't know if it's the right thing. You know, it just happened to be a thing, an option, a good one, whatever, but maybe I won't be saying that when I'm 65. Like, And I just think it's kind of bizarre to be saying it now.
That's what all the life coaches are in their 20s. Have you noticed that? Because you have to, you would have to be in your 20s to have the hubris to tell people how to live their lives.
I feel like I wouldn't have said this even. I think I would never have said this because I always had a complicated relationship with it because I don't think it's a.
See, that's the thing is the piece should have been framed as I made this decision. I have these thoughts about it. Yeah. I look at my friends and I notice this particular phenomenon of dating people your own age. And because women, you know, are women actually teaching these men to be their boyfriends? Are they teaching men to be men as they date their same sex person? Like, I think that's a very interesting concept. All you have to do is say, hey, let's think about it this way. You don't have to make it a prescription.
Yeah. But the prescription is what gets people riled up, you know, right. It put me off immediately, even though in every other way, I mean, not really in every other way, but in many other ways, she's kind of speaking a tune that I'm glad to hear.
See, but again, I mean, I guess it was a success because everybody's talking about it. I think these editors are just throwing their writers under the bus for clicks.
Crazy. They're just trying to rile up the discourse, and it worked. I don't mind it insofar as the conversation that it invokes are interesting, you know, or can have the possibility of being interesting, which is a piece like this, I think, has. The Huberman piece, I wanted to elevate it and move, like, make it about something else, which is what I tried to do. But I, other than like the merits of the actual story, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Huberman, if you're out there, come on. You should come on. I'd like to know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear his thoughts.
Megan's gonna go.
I'm gonna go find him in Topanga Canyon, and Hugo is going to drag Huberman back across town to my studio, my home studio. All right. Is there anything else people need to know?
Rate and review, please. Please, please, please.
Rate and
please,
review. Please. And also I will say that in addition to our on Speakeasy courses, we do have our co-ed on Speakeasy Retreat coming up in Chicago, June 4th and 5th. And our guest speakers are officially announced. They are Nadine Strossen, former ACLU president and prominent free speech advocate. She's not been president of the ACLU for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one, right?
Yep. Eric Smith, the professor of rhetorics and co-founder of Free Black Thought. And Lisa Sellen Davis, who writes and speaks about the new gender movement.
Star-studded.
Gender nonconformity. So, yes, if you are a gentleman, you are welcome at this retreat. Anybody is. It's for everybody. But you do have to apply. Not just for everybody, because you got to get through me. But it is daytime only, not an overnight, not a sleepover. Sorry.
You really have to clarify that.
Yeah. Anyway, theunspeakeasy.com.
All right.
Okay. Well, thanks, y'all. See you next time.